session number 14147, Rule 4.
Rule 4.
Right. Yes, everybody from Captain to Galley Boy was working, and we use union thrutches, that is two, one derrick overside, one amidships, and use two falls and transfer it from one to the other. When it came to the heavier tanks, in excess of 6 tons, we used a swinging derrick, which meant you just lifted it, swung it out and lowered it, which took rather longer. But generally, well, in all cases that I can recall, we started loading, you know, say 6 o'clock in the morning, and by late afternoon we'd finished all the discharge. We were just loading, I suppose we were a couple of hundred yards off the beaches, and we just loaded into these various craft, and they took the stuff ashore, and the troops went with them. And it was a fairly, for us it was uneventful. We could see all this fighting and gunfire ashore, but somehow it never seemed to reach out to us. Nobody actually attacked us. At night we kept continuous watches, because we always waited over one night. We couldn't sail as soon as we finished discharge. We had to wait till first light the next morning. So at night we lay at anchor there, and there was occasional E-boats coming in. No enemy aircraft. In fact, as far as I could make out, our air forces had complete command of the beachheads. I mean, I don't remember any attacks by aircraft, but E-boats kept coming in addition to our armaments. We also had a special tank aft which created smoke. And the idea was that this would confuse any E-boats or even aircraft. So you would turn on this smoking tank, and it would produce clouds of smoke from the outer end of the ship, which is okay as long as the wind and tide were together. But if the wind was against the tide, you know, you could stifle half your shipmates, because it would blow back into the accommodation. But that was a device they put on. They also provided us with barrage balloons from the mainmast on about 1,500 feet of piano wire. We used to put them up to 1,000 feet. So you could, these were worked off drums bolted onto the after winches. But after a while we were told not to use them, because we use them quite often going home and coming out alongside off the coast of Dover, you know. And they reckon that the German artillery could range on our balloons as we were all in convoy steaming in front of Dover and along that coast. So we were told not to hoist the balloons, because it would stop the Germans from shooting at Dover and the other places along the coast. So having loaded, or discharged rather, in a day, we waited overnight, then sailed back again. Took us a whole day to get back. Picked up the pilot at first light the next day, and then up to Tilbury, on to Southwest India. Spent the night there. And then, of course, that was getting a bit hairy, because of all these buzz bombs were coming in around there. It took us a day to load up, and then off we'd go again. And again, we'd sail at night, and my abiding memory is sailing out of the Southwest India docks about 10 o'clock at night, and on each pierhead there were guns, you know, anti-aircraft guns, firing away like mad. And the racket going on when you were trying to get the ship out into the river and turn around so as to head her downstream. But it must have been worse for the people who lived there, I think. Darn sight worse. But, anyway, we did this, I don't know how many trips we made. It was about 5 days overall, and we just kept going backwards and forwards to the beachheads. And there was a spell when we had to lie off, what was it, Ouistreham, because of the very heavy weather. That was somewhere towards the end of June, I think. But apart from that, all went well until sometime in August, coming back. We were off Beachy Head, and I saw, again, I was fortunate, I was on watch about 4 in the morning, or about 3 o'clock in the morning. I had the second mate always had the 12 to 4 watch, so I had the middle watch from midnight till 4, and I also had the afternoon watch from midday until 4 in the afternoon. But this was the middle watch, about 3 o'clock. I saw the ship ahead, turning, then I heard a bang, just like somebody banging a saucepan. I knew it was a torpedo, because, you know, you got used to it, but there's always that impression like somebody banging a saucepan. He swung out, the ship ahead of me swung out, and I had to go harder starboard to avoid hitting him. And I turned through 90 degrees, and I sounded the alarms, fortunately, to get everybody on deck, and the old man had come up, and then suddenly, bang, we got it right on the bow, because we'd swung into it. If we, in the convoy, we'd have got it signed on, but we'd swung off, got it on the bow. Old man sent me forward, and I could see that she was flooded from the stem up to the foremast. But above the foremast, the number two hatch was dry, so I reported. This time he'd stopped the engine, and he then decided to go slow ahead. And he slowly increased the speed. In an hour or two, it started to get light, although it was misty. We suddenly found ourselves right under the cliffs, hauled out, and all of a sudden there was the pilot boat. So we picked up a pilot. The pilot was quite calm about it, I suppose. He was used to this sort of thing, but we told him that we had a ship that had been torpedoed. It was flooded all in the fore end. Engines appeared to be working, but we had no anchors because we had the anchors, they remained, but we had no steam to work them, no way of working them. So an LST came passing by, and we called him up, and the pilot said, would he please, would we ask him to reduce speed so that we could follow him, because our compasses weren't at all reliable after this shock, you know, they were all over the place. But he didn't reduce his speed much, but we followed him, and we got up to, we got further up somewhere off beyond Folkestone it was, where we had plenty of buoys up through the Edinburgh Channel there. Once there, I mean, you can follow the buoys, and you don't really need a compass, and you don't need another ship to follow. And by this time, the mist had gone. We got up to Tilbury, anchored there. They said they couldn't do anything for us. They had too many ships on hand, you know, repairing. We weren't the only one who'd been torpedoed or damaged in some ways, so we'd have to go up north, which was rather amusing. And I remember the old man went and asked the surveyor if he could get a certificate of seaworthiness, which is what you always had to do if as master of a ship if your ship was damaged, to prove that you were seaworthy enough to go to sea. And they just laughed at him and told him to stuff it. So off we went at reduced speed. By this time we were all getting very nervy, and everybody to a man wore their life jackets, which is a thing I've never seen in a merchant ship before or since. We wore, after that torpedo, and once we got over the height, we were wearing our life jackets continuously. Got up off the Humber, thick fog, had to anchor there. Fortunately, they'd put an extension to the steam pipes and connected it up to the windlass so that although we couldn't let the anchor go because the shock would have been too much, we could at least lower the anchor into the water under power and then pull it back again rather gently. So we anchored there for a day or so while the mist cleared. Because, I mean, ships of those time had nothing at all. They only had a magnetic compass. We did have an echo sounder, but there was no electronic devices for fixing your position. I mean, if you couldn't see the land, you just couldn't fix yourself, and that was the end of it. But we eventually got to Middlesbrough, tied up to the buoys, put a lifeboat down to go ashore, and then, of course, out of cussedness, we all had to get in this lifeboat and steer it round the number one hole, because that was flooded, you know, to actually say you'd steam the lifeboat round your own holes with a bit of a laugh. And then she was, well, we left her. She was repaired. They reckon it was going to take about a year for her to get repaired, and she was repaired. And strangely enough, around about 1952, when I was working teaching cadets in London, again at King Edward VII Nautical College, there was a ship there, can't think what the heck her name was. Anyway, I went on board this ship because one of my jobs, if I wasn't actually taking these kids to sea in a boat of some sort or another, I used to take them around the docks and get on board a ship and let them see a real ship. And I went aboard this ship and got up the gangway, and it's something familiar about this ship. And I said to the mate, you know, the chief officer at the time, do you know anything about this ship? And he didn't know a great deal, but the chief steward did. And it turned out she was the Ocean Volga. They'd renamed her, they had her repaired, and she was, we verified it from the plans in the alleyway, that this was the Ocean Volga. So she survived after a lot of trauma. So that was my experience with D-Day, you know. It was more or less going over to the beaches, coming back, going over, coming back.
What did this number one pennant look like?
Number one pennant is simply a white flag with a red circle on it. Number two is a blue flag with a white circle. It's just, you know, it's just part of a code. There was a book, special code books for convoys, that we had, which had all these funny signals in.
And yet you had to go back to sea again even then, before the war ended, in the Empire Buckler.
That's right, I went, I took my survivor's leave. I got my survivor's leave because the ship was torpedoed, even though she didn't sink. But we managed to get her home, I suppose. But I went in the Empire Buckler then because my wife and I had got engaged, at least my present wife, we just got engaged, and I wasn't going back on these Strix or anybody like that. We might be away for 2 years, as I was. So I got into the Holder Line, which runs down from London, Liverpool, to the Argentine with frozen meat. But this particular Empire Buckler, well, we were running across to the States for frozen meat again, two holds frozen meat, the rest general cargo. And our job was to feed the continent now. So we went across to the States, up to Antwerp, and we had quite a bit of bombing there. I mean, everybody in Antwerp was getting bombed at that time in the late 44.
Was this V1s?
I think it's a bit of everything, as I recall, V1s and, you know, general aircraft coming over with bombs, but of course it didn't last long because we began to get mastery of the air up there.
So you were bringing food from North America to the continent?
Yeah. Managed to run ashore on the Scheldt, but that was simply because nobody had any opportunity to dredge or to sort out the boys or do anything, you know. It's quite a hairy business. And so I did that for a bit. And then we...
Was this grain and meat and butter and so on?
Yeah, it was grain. From the States, it was grain and frozen meat. But it wasn't quite the standards that we were used to, because they brought it by open trucks. Not open trucks, but unrefrigerated trucks from the Middle West to New York. And usually we had thermometers that we stuck in a carcass, and if it was too warm, you know, we rejected it. But the Americans wouldn't have it, and there was nowhere they could send the meat. Our only test was that we put our foot on a carcass and grabbed the head and tail and pulled it up. If it bent up and we could make the meat, we rejected it. Otherwise, it was accepted. But so it wasn't a very high standard. But we put it in our holds and froze it down, and I dare say the Belgians and everybody else was happy. And from then onwards, I got into various other holder boats, the Princessa, which was a fully refrigerated, did a voyage down to the Argentine and brought that load back. But that time we went up to Hamburg, and again, we got on so well with the Germans there, you know, because most of the stevedores and the tally clerks and so forth, they were all ex-German naval officers or petty officers, you know, and there was no rancor on either side. In fact, they used to, as a joke, call me Herr Funfelder, because that was their interpretation of five fields, Funfelder.
I don't quite follow why the quality control of the frozen meat was lower. You said because the Americans wouldn't have it. What did you mean?
Well, the point is there was nowhere they could put it. I mean, the stuff was loaded in the mid-states, sent for a couple of days across country to New York, and they couldn't send it all the way back again. When we were loading down in the Argentine, for example, you were alongside a frigorifico, so the stuff came straight out of the freezer into the ship, so there's no chance for it to warm up. These carcasses were, were getting very hot. I mean, I wonder.
How did you feel when the war ended?
How did I feel? Well, it so happened that my wife and I made a pact when we got engaged in 1944, that we'd get married either when the war ended or when I got my master's certificate, whichever came first. Well, it so happened that a few days before VE Day, I was in Cardiff, having come across from New York. We called in at Cardiff before going on to Antwerp or wherever, and I rang up my wife. She said, "It's going to happen soon. Can't we get married?" And I said, "Yes." And her father was an organist at the local church, so he knew all the ropes, and he got her a special license. She said, "Come home as soon as you can." I came home, arrived home VE Day, or the day before VE Day. I remember going up on Horsenden Hill, because whenever there was a big some celebration, everybody went to the top of Horsenden Hill, there's a bonfire, and drank it. But I went up there on that evening, and we got married the day after VE Day. Believe it or not, her father played the organ. Unfortunately, the Oldfield Hotel couldn't refused to give us a reception, because they said, you know, with all the hoo-ha that was going on, with everybody celebrating, in no way could they hold a wedding reception. So we just had to go home, and our two houses were next door to each other, and we had a celebration at home. And so that was my end of the war. I mean, it was euphoria, quite frankly. I remember we got in a taxi to take us up to Waterloo, because we were going down to Bournemouth for to have a short honeymoon there. And as soon as we got out of Greenford, the taxi stopped, and he said, I'm taking off these boots and things that hang over the stern of the taxi. He said, I'm not going to go round Buckingham Palace with that. But I do remember that he took us round Buckingham Palace to get to Waterloo, you know, and the racket that was going on was incredible, everybody running about. He managed to get the taxi through, and we got down to Bournemouth. The funny thing there was that on the train down, we got a first-class seats, because my wife worked on the railway. And sitting next to us was a marine superintendent from the Persian Gulf, who I'd known when I was out there in the Gorgistan. And we apparently, according to Zoe, we spent the whole time having a conversation about the Persian Gulf, and she was sitting there, newly married lady, not being able to take any part in this conversation. And I got down in Bournemouth, of course. Fortunately, I got a telegram saying that my leave had been extended by about 4 days, so we had an extra 4 days in Bournemouth. Instead of three, we had about a week. So that was how I ended the war.
So your wedding day was the 9th of May, 1945?
That's right, yes.